There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1046, June 3rd, 2024, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. Today, Mr. Rogers, we are going to take a trip down memory lane with Miss Jennifer Revson, sister of Peter Revson. And before we start, I would like to thank her very much for inviting me to her place. And hopefully our listeners will enjoy this conversation. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Red Bull expecting problems with curbs at Canada. Ocon to leave Alpine at the end of the season. Still no drive for Sainz Jr., and Fernando's chances seem to have gone poof. And, like Nasser said, this week's big interview, Peter Revson's sister, Jennifer. And I do want to remind everybody that, yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program up on the servers. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. Nast, keep up the good work on this interview. Outstanding. Bring it all in.
Yes, sir. You know, since the start of the Formula One championship in 1950, five drivers from the United States have won championship Grand Prix races. Peter Revson was one of them. His father, Martin, and Uncle Charles started the Revlon Cosmetic Company. Peter was an all-round racer, Grand Prix winner, pole position at the Indy 500, Can-Am champion. He also won the prestigious Monaco Formula 3 race in 1965. This conversation is with his younger sister Jennifer, which took place on May 25th. My sincere thanks to her for inviting me to a place in North Carolina, sharing stories and showing family photos. And, you know, I was a big fan of Peter Revson and Mark Donohue was also racing around the same time. And looking at Peter's briefcase and his winning trophy from Fuji Circuit, of all the places, was very emotional. She also shares interesting stories of her second brother, Doug, who also went racing. And you know, when I was leaving, she said to me, "You have to see my girls." And then she opened the door to her garage. And Jennifer has three, what I would call fast-lapping girls from Germany. Two with the Mercedes Star, and one is a limited edition Porsche, all in pristine condition and ready for a fast drive. Again, many thanks for her time, and hope listeners enjoy this trip down memory lane with sister of Peter Revson, Miss Jennifer Revson. Okay, folks, I'm here in beautiful North Carolina with Miss Jennifer Revson. Jennifer, great to see you. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Nice to see you too.
Now, one of the first thing I learned about your brother, Peter, many, many moons ago, is that his first race, I believe, was in Hawaii, where he was studying, and he drove so hard, he was told not to come back. I understand you were there, and your mom.
Yes. Well, that was a good indication that my mother was never going to be Peter's racing fan, because she was so nervous. Every time he sped by, she practically swooned. I think his car broke down, a Corvette one. He was black flagged or something for being too aggressive.
Okay, well, you know, great racing drivers are aggressive.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Okay, you told me your mom was the car person in the family. Was she supportive of Peter and Douglas's racing adventures?
You know, it's interesting because she was a very good driver. She liked to go fast. We got our love of speed in cars through her, but no, she was not supportive at all. Not a bit.
And I believe your father and uncle, they were even less supportive?
My uncle, I don't even think, you know, he drove a car himself. My father, he didn't understand. A car was transportation. And quite frankly, it's pretty funny that my brothers would turn out to be race car drivers because my father could barely keep a car on the road without hitting something.
Interesting. Okay, growing you folks grew up in New York, right?
Yes.
Growing up with these two boys, brothers, Peter, I understand, was 10 years older than you.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about early days before they got involved in racing and what you remember most?
You mean just about being a sister and yes. stuff we did together? They were very sweet boys. I mean, they teased me, but it wasn't anything that would bring tears to my eyes. I mean, like, for instance, one time I was, I decided to wax the limousine, and I was a child. And I had the white paste wax, and it was all over the car. So Dougie comes out, and he says, "Jenny, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm waxing the car, but I don't know how to get it off." He said, "You know what? What you need is some elbow grease." I said, "Where do you get that?" "Go in the kitchen, look in the drawer." So, I mean, they were teasing like that, but it was fun. Okay, one thing I remember about Doug was I was about 8 years old, I think, 8 or 9. We were in the country in our house in Connecticut, and Dougie was taking me for a drive in Peter's Austin Healey, top down. Speeding down the hill, there's a stop sign ahead, and I'm not sure we're going to blow through it or be able to stop. And right before we get to the stop sign, Dougie says to me above the roar of the car and the wind and everything, he says, "You want to drive?" And he takes his hands off the steering wheel. So I grabbed the steering wheel instinctively, you know, and steered it to the stop sign. And then in one fell swoop, like a magician, he takes the steering wheel off the column, hands it to me, and says, "Here you go, Jenny." So they were fun. They were both fun.
What about Peter was 2 years older than Doug. Were they good buddies, or there was a case of sibling rivalry?
I didn't see the sibling rivalry, but I heard from a friend of theirs that they like to sock each other a bit sometimes. Well, they took, I showed you those pictures, they took boxing lessons when they were kids, so I guess they were practicing on each other, but they got along. They were just, whatever they did, I don't know.
How did they discover, I am guessing Douglas followed Peter going into racing. How did Peter catch the racing bug?
I have to say it was a natural inclination because of, like, my mother and speeding and her getting cars and them practicing, pretending they were race car drivers. We had a very long gravel driveway, back and front driveway, stone walls. They would drift like the big cars around. One thing led to another.
Okay.
And then Peter would take his streetcar to race.
Peter won the very prestigious Monaco Formula 3 race in 1965, and I don't think any American driver has won a single-seater race at Monaco since then. At this stage of his career, did you or your family travel to any of his races, either in the U.S. or overseas?
Not at this time, no. I was a little girl. My mother would have had to take me, and she wasn't into watching Peter race, and my father wasn't interested. So, no, unfortunately, I didn't get to see that.
Okay. Now, I understand family and family business. Revlon were not backing him financially, even though that's what all the videos say. Can you share with us how Peter was raising sponsorship to go racing?
Okay, so here's the thing. When you think about it, putting it into perspective, when he was 18, I was 8. Okay. I have no idea how he did anything, really.
Okay.
He wouldn't tell me. I mean, not that he wouldn't tell me, but it would never have come up. I know he did some whatever jobs he got and would save his money and, like I said, use his streetcar, tape up the headlights, whatever he needed to do to go to a race. So I wasn't really privy to that information. I'm sorry.
No worries. In 1967, tragedy struck the family for the first time. Doug lost his life in a race in Denmark. You told me that Chris Economy was the one who told Peter about it.
Yes.
And I understand Peter was at a race,
yes.
a Trans Am race. How did your parents and you heard about this?
Oh, that was a terrible day. This is bizarre. I was in my car with a couple of friends. We were listening to the radio, having a fun day, and the radio station interrupted the music and made the announcement. So it was bizarre. I couldn't even believe it. I just was terrible. As far as how my parents found out, I'm not sure. You know, I've got a lot of black holes during that time. And my parents weren't together at that time in life anymore. And so I really don't remember.
Did anybody among your parents ask Peter to stop racing?
Oh, yes. There was a very dramatic scene leaving Dougie's funeral, walking down the steps of the church. Peter was walking in another direction, and my mother said, "Peter, where are you going?" And he said, "I have to drive to New Hampshire. I have a race this weekend." And she practically fainted on the steps, and she said, "Please don't go." And he said, "I have to." And I just remember him taking off in the car. But that was very Peter-like also. If he gave his word that he was going to be someplace and a lot of people were counting on him, he kept his word. It was a terrible situation. It was very sad to see him go.
In 1971, Peter won pole position for the Indy 500 and finished second in the race. A great achievement. Did he ever talk to you about his racing victories or tell you any interesting stories from the track?
No, he really didn't. The only thing I can think of was when he was partnering with Steve McQueen for 1970, at Sebring, he said to me afterwards, I don't mean at the track, but sometime afterwards, if it wasn't for Steve, we would have won. So I'm figuring he meant because of Steve's foot, had a broken foot.
Same year, 1971, he became the first American to win the Can-Am Championship. I understand some years ago you were at an event where a Can-Am car was announced as the one driven by Peter Revson, which was not the case, and you were not happy. Can you please tell us more about this?
Oh, that was like a two-year thing. It was 2009. I met the Monterey Historics for the first time, and I run across this car. I couldn't believe it. It looked like it was all dressed up to look like Peter's championship-winning M8F McLaren. With his name on it and everything. And for some reason, it looked a little different to me. I couldn't tell you why, but I thought, well, I'm just going to be polite and go along with it and sit in the car and pose for pictures like the owner wants me to, blah, blah, blah. So right after leaving the garage area was the first of many people that came up to me and said, "That's a fake. That's not your brother's car." So the next time I saw it, I was at Amelia Island at the Concours. And there was the car on the show field, this fake car. And I said to one of my friends who I was walking with, Don Devine, who owned, at the time, Peter's M20, which was a 72 Can-Am car, I said, "How do they allow this to happen on such a prestigious event?" And he just shook his head, "I don't know." And then another person who was with us, who was also showing that day, said, "They don't care. It's just all for show." Well, so the next thing I see is this retired race car driver in this fake car, revving it up, drawing a crowd around, you know, and I said, I can't stand this. It's terrible. They're just pretending it's Peter's car and it's not, and all these fans think it's Peter's car. So I walked up to one of the judging officials and I introduced myself and I told him about the situation. And he went over and talked to the owners, and Don Devine, my friend who I was with, went over and said something, and what they came back with, not the judge, but my friend came back with, was so awful. These people were awful. And anyway, one thing led to another, and it was like a two-year fight, and I was totally out of my zone about talking about this at the time. I did radio shows. Well, I usually don't. This is my first podcast with you,
thank
actually.
You.
But anyway... So I gathered all this information. I talked to like two really well-known historians. I saw pictures of rivet patterns on the real car versus the non-real car. I found out that the car was at the Lauman Museum, in the Netherlands. And I have a letter from Mr. Lauman telling me blah, blah, blah. He bought the car when he bought the Rosso Bianco collection. I came with the collection. So anyway, all these backup things. And at the same time, Vintage Motorsport Magazine was printing all these false stories from the owner. But after 2 years, with a lot of help from my friends, it was put to rest. He finally gave up, and it was sold, and it was the Commander Motorhomes car. And it wasn't built till 1973.
Wow. Well, good for you for pursuing this. Okay, speaking of sitting in a car, some years ago you sat in your brother's AMC Javelin.
Yes.
And did a lap. What was that like, and the power and the feeling?
Okay, that was really fun. So I met the owner of one of the historic Trans Am cars, and he had Peter's number 3 Javelin. And he said, I would like you to drive it in the parade lap before the 12-hour race, you know, when all the historic Trans Am cars go out. I said, okay, well, all right. It felt like I was in a truck. Because it had a big Hurst shifter with a big long throw, and I was used to, like, you know, a sports car with a regular throw. But, and a support guy went out with me, you know, because I didn't know what, like, where you're supposed to line up or what you're supposed to do. And it was really neat. It was very emotional. You could tell, like, the corner workers waving, and people said they had tears in their eyes, you know, driving the car. But it was really nice. It was a wonderful experience. I'm really glad I did it.
Now, Peter was in a relationship with Marjorie Wallace from Indianapolis, who had been crowned Miss World. Did you get to know her, and any idea where she is now?
Oh, how can I say this? First of all, that relationship was really blown out of proportion. It wasn't anything nearly what it was written up to be. And as far as how well I knew Margie, let's just say that I personally witnessed why, in my opinion, she was dethroned as Miss World. That's it. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Any idea where she is now?
No. But, you know, it was a long time ago, and yeah. I have no idea.
Okay. In 1973, and I remember these races very well, your brother won 2 Formula One races, both in the rain. And this must have been a source of great pride and joy for you and your parents.
I can't speak for my parents because they didn't really say anything. But I was very proud of Peter. And as a matter of fact, I was en route to a friend's house in another state, you know, flying in. And they had the TV on the British Grand Prix the last few minutes. And I just remember, like, screaming and jumping up and down and so happy for him. I'm so proud.
Yeah. Did he say anything to you when he came back home?
You know, he was so laid back and not talking about himself. And if he said something, I don't remember. It wasn't like, did you see I won? He wasn't that kind of a person.
Now, this I find very interesting from the 73 season. Peter Revson from the Revlon family business had Yardley sponsorship. I understand Peter worked the deal all by himself?
Yes, he did. He approached Revlon, and Revlon said, heck no. Like, what do we want to do anything about racing? You know, whatever. And so, fine. He just went to Yardley. I don't know who he called or how he did it, but he got it on his own. So when people say, well, it's interesting that there's a Yardley sponsorship, it's like, well, it's even more interesting that my brother got the Yardley sponsorship himself.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, this day and age, drivers have a team of managers, PR agents, and gatekeepers. Did Peter manage his own affairs and contracts, or did he also have a manager? You mentioned IMG.
Yes, he was with IMG, and I guess they handled all the contractual situations for him.
Yeah, okay.
At least for the end.
Now, Peter and Teddy Mayer were friends, I believe, from college days. At the end of the 73 season, Teddy dropped Peter from the McLaren team. Do you know if that affected their personal friendship?
It had to have. Peter was very disappointed. I think he was hurt. You know, I mean, he just won 2 Grand Prix and doing his best, and he was hurt.
I understand Ferrari was talking to him for the following season.
I understand that, too. I didn't know it then, but I understood it then that that's not something he wanted to do because they were limiting him of what he could do, and the pay was less than what he was used to making.
Now, for the 74 season, he joined the UOP Shadow Team run by Don Nichols, a man of mystery. Did your brother talk to you about him or other drivers he was racing against?
No, I never heard anything from him about Don Nichols. Just never did.
Did you ever meet him?
No.
Yeah, he was quite a character. Now, you said something to me earlier which really blew me away, that you met Denny Holmes' sister, and he and Peter were teammates. Would you mind sharing with us what she said to you when you met her some years ago?
Okay, well, when I went to the 40th Can-Am reunion at Road America, Denny's sister, Anita Hume, was there, and we were standing, you know, with drinks in hand, having a lovely time at cocktail party, and somehow out of the blue, she said about Denny. Denny decided to quit racing when he was in the shower washing off the blood from Peter's suit. something like that. Was just, it was a lot to take in because it was so unexpected and it was so personal. And yet, you know, when I think back about it, it's like, good for her. What a brave thing to say. She wanted to tell me something so nice. Yeah. I mean, it was gruesome in a way, but I think it was sweet of her to have told me that, actually.
Yeah. Do you recall where you were when he had his unfortunate accident and you got the news?
Oof. Yes. This is an odd situation. I got a phone call very early in the morning, woke me up from a sleep where I was talking to Peter in my dream. And so when the person was telling me the situation, I said, how could he be dead? I was just talking to him. And then, you know, as it started to sink in, at least the message, and after we hung up, I remember sitting in my room on my bed in like deafening silence and feeling like something had just left the room, like a, I can't even explain it, like a spirit, like a something just left the room, and I was just hysterically crying. It's terrible.
I was reading your brother's autobiography, Speed with Style, which is one of the best racing books I have ever read. And the story of Taxi Driver in Argentina really hit me hard. It really shows the human side of Peter Revson.
Yes, that's a lovely story, actually. So when he went to Argentina, apparently during those days, you had to be careful about being kidnapped. So they took good care of them, so he said. And there was like a policeman on every floor of the hotel, and they gave them a driver. And this particular driver's name was Joseph. And apparently he was very aggressive and to the point where Denny got on the floor of the car, of his car, that car. And Jean-Pierre, is it Jarier?
Jarier
called out, por favor, Joseph, you know, like, stop. Well, anyway, so Peter was describing in his book about the way Joseph was handling the car, that it wasn't like he was showing off, but that he had a command of the car. It was his car. It was a Peugeot. And he was taking good care of them and trying to get them to where they needed to go quickly. And after Peter was hit in the first lap of that race, and so he had a very bad race, he was saying how Joseph was like the most concerned and compassionate person that he met there about his circumstance. And he really appreciated that. And in the broken English, you know, Peter was trying to communicate with them and with him. And at the end of their time together, when Peter dropped him off, when Joseph dropped Peter off at the airport, Joseph asked if he could be his driver for next year.
That really touched me.
It was sweet. It was very sweet.
Very, very cute. I understand a few years ago you were approached for a movie about Peter. Would you be interested in giving some background on this?
Actually, I've been approached several times over the years. The first time was right after Peter was killed, which was too soon to even think about that with anybody. Plus, I already knew the person who was George Hamilton. I'd met him at a party at our house once, and I didn't think he was the right person. And then Bruce Jenner, who is now Caitlyn Jenner, did a big push to portray Peter in a movie. This was in the 80s. And I just, at the time, I met with him and his then-wife and their agent, and I just didn't get a good feeling. I thought he was very nice, but I didn't get a good feeling that he would be good for this, and in hindsight, that would have not been good at all. And then in 2014 was the last time that two people came to me. And they were partners. They were in LA, producers. One producer, I have to say, was very nice. The other guy was really pushy. And anyway, the whole thing was to get to Harvey Weinstein to make the movie, because the Weinstein Company was an independent film studio that they were trying to get to. And basically, they couldn't get to first base and wasted a year of my life. But in retrospect, look at how that turned out. That would have been a disaster.
Yeah. Now, in looking back, what are you most proud of your brother's achievement, and how do you want their legacy to be remembered?
You know, I'm obviously proud of their accomplishments in racing and what they started with and how they ended up. I don't, you know what I mean, as far as their accomplishments. But I'm most proud of really the way they were as human beings. They were nice guys. They were good people. They were polite. They were bright. They were concerned about other people. And I just think that's the most important thing, to be a kind person walking the earth. And that's how I view both my brothers. It's just kind men.
And Jennifer, I understand you have a couple of stories for us. So let's hear them, please.
Okay. Well, so this is a message that came through on my Facebook page, a private message, rather. And it says, in conversation at dinner the other night, we were all discussing Formula One drivers of the past, and your brother's name came up. My wife suddenly came alive, and she said that he once saved her life. And she told me the most incredible story. And I'm thinking to myself, she's just telling you now. 50 years ago, she was a jet-setting playgirl written up in Cosmo, etc. She spent a lot of time in Greece and Spain, but this time it was Greece, and your brother noticed she was with a gentleman, quote-unquote, he knew or knew of, and was getting to take her aboard a yacht belonging to someone she shouldn't be near, arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. So when she left with him, Peter got two women to board the yacht that was getting ready to sail and grab her to get her off. He told her that there would have been a strong chance that she would never come back. So that's the way it was. So your brother had her flown off the island so they couldn't find her.
Wow.
That's amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, incredible story there. And you have one from Mr. Matthew Jeffries?
Well, no, Matthew Jeffries is friends with this person, Rich, who wrote me this story. And he said, my friend and I'm just going to read it. My friend and I attended all 4 days of the Grand Prix weekend. He was talking about the British Grand Prix that Peter won. And on the Saturday, a race day morning, we spotted Peter coming over the pedestrian bridge from outside to inside, from inside to outside the circuit, sorry. Peter was relatively unknown to the average British racing fan, but even in those early days, I was well aware of who he was. In effect, he was incognito and wasn't mobbed by fans. I hope you can imagine my surprise when he followed my friend and I into the queue for the gents' toilets. I plucked up the courage to wish him well for the race later that day, and he thanked me. He seemed genuinely surprised and pleased that I had recognized him. So after we exited the facility, he asked if I knew where the betting tent was, because the outside of the circuit was very crowded, with dozens of shops, cafes, and burger bars. My friend and I escorted him to the betting tent, where Peter was surprised to see his odds for winning the Grand Prix were 200-1. So anyway, they walked over there, and Peter was surprised to see his odds for winning.
So did he bet on it, on himself?
Yeah.
And how much did he win?
Peter told us he was going to win his first Grand Prix that day and pulled out a clip of pound notes and wagered it on himself, maybe 100 to 200 pounds sterling, because he was relatively unknown in Britain and he not yet won a Grand Prix. But I thought that was funny how they met him in the men's room.
Yeah. Good. Now, finally, we have listeners all over the world, and a lot of them are very passionate about history of motor racing. Would you have a message for them?
Just thank you so much for being supportive of my brother in the past. And I do enjoy still hearing stories from people that I've never heard stories from before, like they named their poodle after him, Revson the dog, or their child. Somebody named their child Revson. Anyway, I do enjoy the stories, and thank you so much for supporting my brothers when they were racing. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Jennifer, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Back to you, Nasser.
Yes, sir. I would also like to thank Mr. Bob Steele of Performance Motorsports Network, also a member of F1 Weekly Familia, for making this conversation possible. It was he who put me in touch with Jennifer, so we're very happy with cooperation from all sides. And, sir, we shall now go to Motorsports Mondial.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir. Now, a lot of this season is really, I've never seen a season like this. It just keeps giving surprises one after the other, and we're not even halfway through the season. Now, this was not a surprise, but came in pretty quickly. Shah, or Cat, is out of the bag at Alpine. One-hit wonder Esteban Ocon heard the news from the Western Union man. Your services are no longer required. Both the team and driver have announced they are taking separate roads after the 2024 season is over. Everybody knew the Ocon-Gasly combo will not work at Alpine, or any other team for that matter. My understanding is Ocon is still under Toto Wolff management and his name has been linked with Haas F1 and Williams. And let's see where he goes. Last year Esteban was on the podium in Monte Carlo, but in the last race there a week ago he pasteurized Pierre Gasly, his own teammate. Ocon's departure from the team is no surprise. According to him, news will be announced in due course. So I think he has already settled his affairs for 2025. So that'll be good for him. Before Ocon's departure was announced, the team operations director Rob White was shown the door after 20 years at the team. So I have no idea what the higher-ups at Alpine are trying to do. In an F1 gone wild, the real juicy stuff were reports that Flavio Briatore may come back to Enstone, not on a full-time basis, but as a special advisor to Renault CEO Luca Di Meo. I say, why not bring back Nelson Piquet Jr. also as driver coach? Your thoughts on where Gasly is going and who is going to replace him?
And of course, you mean Ocon and...
Yeah, excusez-moi.
Of course, no. Well, Ocon, like you said, is managed by Wolfie. And Toto knows what to...
Wolfie?
I call him Wolfie on the weekends. And Toto knows what he's doing. You know, he could very well wind up at Audi. You never know. He's a good driver. He's just sort of thick-headed and causes a lot of trouble with his teammate. So, depending on who the teammate is, I don't know. It is too bad that the attitude is the problem, because he has good driving skills, or Toto wouldn't be paying so much attention.
Yes. Now, as far as who will partner Gasly in 25, well, I'm assuming he does not bail out, because earlier there were reports that both Alpine drivers were looking elsewhere, and who can blame them the way the car is? Jack Doohan is their reserve driver. Mick Schumacher is also on the Alpine books. The team cannot have Jack Doohan on the outside looking in season after season. They need to put him in Formula One in 2025, for better or worse, or they will have another Oscar Piastri situation. Now, Mick Schumacher, this is just my personal opinion, I don't think he's coming back in Formula One. He is lucky to have a factory ride with Alpine in the WEC series. Now there are reports that Mr. Dale Coyne may be interested in having a Schumacher in IndyCar racing. You know what? I'll tell you that this Mick Schumacher in IndyCar is not going to work out. And here is the reason. Fans in America, they love a winner. So if you're winning, they will like you. But if you come here and not winning, which is hard to win with a small team, and then I'm not saying he's going to cop an attitude, but he is very well controlled, managed in terms of who can talk to him. And of course, because of the name, because of the circumstances with his papa, his accessibility will be very, very limited. And I don't think that's going to go down well with American fans. What's your take on that?
I completely agree. He is not acclimated to the hot dog free-for-all here in the United States. And they would be still expecting quite a bit from him. And let's not forget that the Indy cars are like 30-year-old technology, no power steering. They bump and grind, they shake and bake, and I just don't see Schumacher being part of that kind of environment.
If he was coming with the top team, you know, Ganassi, Penske, that's another story. But I think a back of the bus or a small team is just not going to work out. But, you know, we wish him all the best. Okay, sir, moving on to the Red Bull camp. Reports are Sergio Perez will stay with the team. It's all signed, sealed, and soon to be delivered. This is not good for Honey Badger, as I think Yuki Tsunoda will stay at Visa Cash App as long as it is powered by Honda. At the same time, Dr. Marco has to put Liam Lawson in a Formula One seat. So we may have a Kiwi replace an Aussie at Visa Cash App RB in 2025. Of course, subject to official confirmation. The way things are going for Honey Badger, do you think he deserves another year at the team that's entry level for Formula One drivers?
No, and I feel bad for him, but he really has lost his mojo. He's not... Ever since he went to McLaren, something just went and said bye-bye. I'm not quite sure how talent works sometimes, but, I mean, he's got so many other things he can do that I think it's time to move on and let's get Liam a drive.
You know, the interesting thing was he was quite a match for Max, first of all, at Red Bull. And then when he went to Renault, he got, I think, two podiums there. But what was really impressive there, that Nico Hülkenberg, for the first time in his career, met somebody he could not overpower in terms of performance. So he was doing pretty good, even at Renault, but I just have no idea what happened at McLaren, where he was just like completely lost, and now he cannot even run with a Pokemon. So I think his dishes are done. Yeah, I would love to see Liam Lawson. And again, you know, you have to give the man or the woman an opportunity to show what they can do. And then after a season, or in the case of two seasons, we can see what they do, as was the case with Logan Sargeant. Now, interestingly, reports are now saying that Yuki may drive for Audi, as Carlos Sainz Jr. is taking his sweet time to decide where he wants to go. I don't think Yuki's wasabi attitude will go down well with Andreas Seidel and his German think tank at Sauber. But heck, you know, if he's bringing 10, 20 millions from Honda Savings and Loan Association, might not be a bad idea. The kid is quick. I mean, there is no question about that. Any other changes you see in Formula One, Williams, or our favorite Haas F1?
Yeah, obviously there's going to be changes. We know Mag is going to be gone for sure. Well, I don't want to say that, but he could be banned for a few races. And we know that Hülkenberg is off to Audi, since that's why he's been smiling so much, competing with Ricciardo. But yeah, we have a lot of changes coming up. The Alpine angle is very, very interesting. Depending on if Flavio does get in the door, he could bring interesting names into the fold. So it could be a very, very weird season. And on the other hand, things could really get weird if Max and Red Bull start falling backwards. Because if that happens, Max is going to have a tizzy. And we don't know what that could cause. So keep your ears to the railroad tracks. There's noise up ahead.
Yeah, you know, with Flavio coming back, it will be like a special advisor. But, you know, I remember Frank Montani, who was once in the Renault Driver Development Program. And we all know Flavio did make things happen, sometimes maybe too much. But they need somebody like him to get this thing going. If Bruno Famaia stays there, pretty soon they'll have nobody in management or lower management. It'll be just two drivers and maybe a couple of mechanics, the way things are going.
It could be that way. Or maybe they could become more like Hesketh, with shrimp and champagne for everybody every day.
There you go. I really just cannot see Alpine Renault putting all this kind of money. And I mean, the car is, I mean, far from being competitive, let alone, you know, top of the grid. So we'll see how it works out. Look at some of the sports, and then we'll talk more Formula One. Italian MotoGP from Mugello, sponsored by Brembo, not making this up. Local riders on Ducati 1-2, Francesco Bagnaia was the winner over Enea Bastianini. Third was Spanish rider Jorge Martin. He leads the championship with 171 points. Race winner Bagnaia is second with 153 points. And third in the championship is Marc Marquez on 136 points. And I read today that most likely Marc Marquez will drive for the factory Ducati team starting next season. Do you remember when this kid came on the scene in MotoGP? He rattled the cage of Rossi and everybody and was so successful. Then he had a rash of accidents one after the other. And his mojo is coming back. And I would love to see him get another championship like the man like him on four wheels. We all know who that is. Okay, WRC World Rally Championship Sardinia off the coast of Italy. Toyota driver Sebastian Ogier was on his way to victory when he had a Mansell moment on the last stage. Tire done blowed up, cost him victory by 0.2 second, which I am told is like the second time this has happened, and the 0.2 second is the closest ever finish in WRC event. Winner was Ott Tänak from Estonia in his Hyundai. His Hyundai teammate Danny Sordo finished third. Belgian Thierry Neuville leads the championship with 122 points. Tänak and Elvin Evans are joint second with 104. And, you know, just as an information, a couple of years ago I wrote an email to a PR lady who handles Patrick Head's affair, and I told her, you know, I'm coming to Heathrow. Will it be possible to do an interview with Patrick Head? And she responded, sorry, Patrick Head now resides in Sardinia. And I'm sure by the time I write to her that, hey, I'm going to Sardinia, I may get her email that he's now, you know, living in Mallorca or some other place. But we'll see what we can do to reach Mr. Head. IndyCar race, did you watch this Detroit destruction?
I did. It's a caution festival.
It certainly was. Santino Ferrucci doing what he does best, pissing off people. Scott Dixon doing what he does best, and that is winning races. I don't know what his total is, but one of these days he's going to pass AJ Foyt's all-time record of IndyCar wins. You know, he has already passed Mario Andretti, who I think had like 52 or 54 IndyCar wins. So he's already second on the all-time list, so, you know, good for him. And, you know, he has been driving for the same team, Ganassi, for almost two decades now. And that has to be some sort of a new track record. Okay, sir, now looking ahead, we have round 9 of 24 in Montreal this weekend. We are not even halfway through the season. We already have two teams, other than Red Bull, that have tasted victory, so which is very good for competition. Let's hope the trend continues on Sunday. Here's the interesting part about the Montreal circuit. It has seen many maiden wins. For Thierry Boutsen, birthday boy with winning motivation, Jean Alesi, Lewis Hamilton, Robert Kubica, Daniel Ricciardo, and the local man whose name is on the circuit, Monsieur Gilles Villeneuve. This is a fast track with long straights. Last year, Max gave Red Bull their 100th Grand Prix win and shared the podium with Alonso and Hamilton. Remember these two drivers?
Yeah, I do remember those guys. Where are they now?
Yeah, they used to win races and championships, but then something happened. Max got in the way. Safe to say these two will not be seen in top three on Sunday. I say it will be Max versus Prancing Horse. Charles Leclerc has got the momentum since Monaco, and if he can stay away from the wall of champions, then I think he has a very good chance to reduce the championship gap to Max. In terms of a new winner in Formula One, I fancy Oscar Piastri. Other expectations from the Why Am I Not Surprised folder will be K-Mac cutting off somebody, Logan Sargeant again missing the beat and not out-qualifying anybody, Ricciardo smiling even after out in Q1. What's your take on the Grand Prix, sir?
It's going to be tough. I think it's going to be tougher on Red Bull than people believe. And this track is brutal on brakes. I remember Williams getting disqualified for oversized brake ducts. So things can happen, and the curbs are very brutal. or as they say, the sausages. So I think we're going to hear Max crying in FP1, FP2. Whether they make the adjustment or not, we shall see. Ferrari will be strong. Ferrari like and feel comfortable in Canada. And if we bring up Canada, we cannot rule out your love of LCH. He does well here. He could do well here. And Mercedes has shown some promise. So it's going to be brutal. And if Max again does not win, there's going to be turmoil inside the team. Just what we want to see, Nasser.
Yes, and speaking of LCH, I think both LCH and Michael Schumacher have the most number of wins in the Canadian Grand Prix, 7 each. So, yeah, it has been happy hunting grounds for him. But, you know, if you want, when you go hunting, especially for the foxes, you need a loaded gun. And if you have a gun with no spicy bullets, then you're struggling to get into Q2 and crying. You know what I was thinking about the LCH situation? His party is over at Mercedes, okay? I think what they should do, on a mutually respectfully part company at the halfway season, and put in Andrea Kimi Antonelli in his car and see what he can do. Because Lewis is not going to do anything, nor will George Russell with what they have right now. And so at least ease the pain. What say you?
I think that's a good idea. And Antonelli needs the seat time for sure and the experience. And LCH doesn't need the seat time and the experience. So that's really a good idea, Nasser. I like that. And you know, over the weekend, I fired up my VHS and watched Speed TV's coverage of the 2002 Spa-Francorchamps race, where we even had Anthony Davidson in a Minardi. So it was very cool watching the old guys, Juan Pablo Montoya. It was a great podium with Ralph. That was a wonderful race. And Schumacher dominating, winning. Well, he could have won by 20 seconds, but he tones it down on the last lap and lets everybody sort of catch up. I mean, I mean Rubinho, of course. But yeah, fun for me, Nas. And keep up the good work on those ideas.
You know, I've been watching a lot of, now that I have time on hand every day, you know, I've been watching a lot of old races, not just Formula One, but sports cars and British touring cars. And it's very nice to, especially when you're watching a race that you watched live and you're watching it now, you know, 25, 30 years later, it's very, very interesting. And once upon a time, a friend of mine had made, put all these races that he had on VHS on DVDs, and then we would watch randomly one race, and it was very interesting, and he would tape everything, all the ads, and there was some very, you know, nice. I remember Yamaha used to have ads for their bikes in the late 80s, early 90s, and those were very nice ads, and Acura used to run ads for using Formula One cars in the days of Senna and Gerhard Berger. So good memories do come back.
Yeah, and the good part is you get to see names that you forgot about that you love and adored while they were racing. Like one of your favorites, Alex Jung.
Alex Jung, you know, I remember watching his following his career. He was rushed through the system, and I could not believe how quickly they brought him into Formula One. And I think that could have worked, but then he got to Minardi, and his teammate was young guy. I don't remember his name. He just ruined his career right there and there. Who was that at Minardi once upon a time, Mr. Rogers?
Some young machismo.
Yes. Oh, you know, speaking of machismo, I am seriously, seriously thinking, because, you know, there are things I need to do, check out on the bucket list items, and one of them is to go to Oviedo and to the Fernando Alonso Museum. And what I did today, you know, if it works out, fine. If not, we're not going to cry over spare mango lassi. But this morning, I called Dr. Marco's office because he had told me to call his assistant. And I did get her on the phone, and she says, okay. I said, you know, per his request, I'm coming to Austria second week of July. Get me a 30-minute time slot. I'll show up at one of his fancy hotels in Graz. So apparently he was not in today, so she said, I will talk to him tomorrow and give you a call. So if that works out, I will be very, very happy. You know, he was a school friend of Jochen Rindt, He at one time even had a team in IRL, Indy Racing League, believe it or not. And of course, successful at Le Mans and all the stories he has about Ricciardo. And I will ask him about arguing with Jaime Alguersuari, which is on YouTube. That's a classic Dr. Marco moment. So let's see what happens. But I'm seriously thinking of, you know, Oviedo is like, it's like coming to California and then going to Barstow. You know, it's not like you hop on a plane and go to LAX. So it's up in the northwestern part of Viva España. But I'm seriously thinking of making a run there. And that should be fun. Who knows, he might be there that day. Wouldn't that be something?
That would be something. And because he's such a loving person, he would embrace you and give you a good hour of fun and entertainment.
And you know, he has cars from his career, which includes the European Formula 3000 series. So if he's there, I'm going to ask him, is this your GP2 car? Because that's what Formula 3000 became, GP2. So we shall see. So I'm trying to do a few things and see what we can do and come back with some interviews, which is really the focus and goal of our life right now. Okay, so in June, we're going to have 3 Formula One races, okay? Montreal this weekend, Spanish Grand Prix on June 23rd in Barcelona, and at the end of the month, we have the Austrian Grand Prix at the beautiful Red Bull Ring. Do you remember races? I'm sure you have watched races at the old Österreich Ring.
Indeed.
Man, that track, and we're talking 70s and early 80s, that track, the original Silverstone and Monza, that's all you needed in the world of motor racing. These 3 fast, beautiful tracks. And now Monza is still pretty much the same. They've made changes to Silverstone also, but it still has that, what you call je ne sais quoi. But the Austrian Grand Prix track has been totally butchered like Hockenheim Ring. But it's still a beautiful facility. I was there. And beautiful setting and a very, very nice Grand Prix, I have to say. So, you know, we'll see. Also on the agenda, sir, I'm trying to make it. If I do this trip in July, especially if Dr. Marco said he's going to meet me, then Budapest is not too far from Vienna. And the Hungarian Grand Prix is happening sometime in July. So I will see if I can make a run to Buda and Pest and attend a Grand Prix there. I definitely would like to see the track. And it's not Monza or Spa, but, you know, how many times we'll go to Hungary? That's the issue. So we'll see. Anything else, sir, you have on your mind you want to discuss about Formula Uno? Oh, speaking of past weekend, also my thanks to F1 Weekly Familiar member and your man in your neighborhood, Mr. Dan Wardman. We had a very nice conversation, and which we will play hopefully sometime this month. So that was very nice to talk to him about his interests and travels and meeting Monsieur Roger.
Ah, Nasser, you're such a funny guy. But no, I'm looking forward to Canada. It's a fun race to watch, and I like Canada. I've been there back in 2010, which was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful day to be there. And yes, we've got fun stuff. And McLaren, you know, they're on a roll.
Yeah, I was in Montreal for the Grand Prix. I think it was 2005. Man, it was so hot, you would not believe on Saturday. But the race was great. This was the race where Monty got screwed by McLaren. I think they either did not bring him into the pit lane at the right time. But if I remember, Fisico was on pole, and then Kimi Raikkonen ended up winning the race. But it's a good place to go to for a race. And I'm really surprised that I've only been there once. But then again, you know, even Montreal was like a 6-hour flight when I was in California. But we'll see what we can do moving forward.
Absolutely. And you know, another point about watching the 2002 Spa-Francorchamps Belgian Grand Prix, with, of course, Michael Schumacher dominating, was the amount of kablamos from every manufacturer. I mean, there was no one or the other that was better. I mean, the Mercedes blew up of Kimi Raikkonen's, that took him out of the race. Fisichella's blow up was fantastic. The Hondas had glorious kablamos. Ah, and the Renaults, of course, truly out kablamo. So it was very interesting on how the perspective was completely different, and they were running on the limit at every race, and they were blowing up at every race. So it was fun to watch.
I think these were the days of 18,000 RPMs.
Correcto. When Kablamo happened, it was a legit Kablamo, not a little wussy one.
There you go. Okay, sir, finally we have a flashback to Peter Revson winning his first Grand Prix at Silverstone, 1973. I would like to thank all the listeners for listening, Ms. Jennifer for her time, and Mr. Rogers for calling me every time on time. Thank you.
Thank you, and good night.
On lap 37, Fittipaldi loses drive to his rear wheels. Francois Soler, number 6. Lap 52, Revson in the lead. But then Holm in number 7 overtakes Hunt in 27. And it's Revson racing towards the finish with Peterson second and Holm third. Revson, Peterson, Holm and James Hunt in a Hesketh march forward. American Peter Revson wins the British Grand Prix 1973 in a Yardley McLaren Ford.
Congratulations, first ever Grand Prix win. How does it feel?
Oh, it feels great. I've been waiting a long time for this.
I remember you here at Silverstone in 1964. It must seem a long, long time ago.
It sure does. And since then, my ambition was to win a Grand Prix, and I'm glad it could be the British Grand Prix.